Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. I'm producer Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We record on Monday morning. So I've actually posted this on Facebook. I can't talk about it. I can't quote it enough. It is a quote by Seth Abramson, who is an attorney. He's provocateur. He's very smart. He's got a huge following on X, and he's had lots of connections in where he has taught. But this is what he said, and I want people to hear this because this is what I want to scream at every time I watch MSNBC and CNN. Demanding viewpoint diversity when one viewpoint is supported by evidence and the other, lunacy, isn't even-handedness. It is derangement. Let me repeat that. Demanding viewpoint diversity when one viewpoint is supported by evidence and the other lunacy, frankly, and lies, isn't even-handedness, but derangement. Think about that. That's what I want to scream at NBC and CNBC and ABC and CBS and CNN. The lunacy has its media sources, but what they've done now is that their toxicity has been drained into every other kind of media outlet. All right, joining us right now are Bob Lord. He is the senior advisor at the of tax policy at Patriotic Millionaires, a group that I'm very familiar with. I've never met Kenny Stancil. He is a senior researcher at the Revolving Door Project, although I am familiar with the Revolving Door Project, Kenny. It is a project that scrutinizes executive branch appointees to ensure they use their office to serve the broad public interest. And the reason why it's called the Revolving Door Project is because we see they go from the corporate world into the regulatory world, from the regulatory world back into the corporate world, and vice versa. And Mary Jo White is someone who I think about all the time when I think about the Revolving Door Project, because if she is like your icon or the personification of yeah, it is her. Anyway, let me thank both Bob Lord and Kenny for joining us. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
It's good to be here, Arnie.
All right. So, Bob, you pitched me this story that was written, I believe it is at Slate.com. And I go to Slate all the time. And it was entitled, Why Biden Should Pardon the IRS Whistleblower Who Leaked Trump's Taxes and Make Billionaire Corruption a Defining Issue of the 2024 Presidential Race. Well, what we know about Donald Trump is that he basically tells you over and over again how rich he is, how successful he is, that he was going to self-fund his campaign. And yet, for some reason, we never got to see what was actually in his taxes. You know, everybody else has always been forthcoming about this public disclosure of wealth, where it comes from, how much they have. And Donald Trump, who basically played wealth as the entire raison d'etre for his election, he was the one that wanted to make sure that you never knew anything about his wealth. What I learned from this article was about a gentleman I'd never heard of. So let me just start with the opening paragraph so we understand really that this isn't just about Trump's taxes. It's about the whistleblower that exposed a lot of very wealthy people's taxes. And you write, this is what Kenny wrote, because Kenny, you are the author of this piece. There's a strong moral case for President Joe Biden to pardon a fellow I've never heard of, Charles Littlejohn. Hold on to that name. The former IRS contractor who was recently sentenced to 5 years in prison for leaking the tax records of Donald Trump, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, and other billionaire tax cheats. Over the past several years, Littlejohn's whistleblowing enabled revelatory reporting by the New York Times and ProPublica on tax avoidance by the super rich. Ideally, tax returns in the U.S. should be readily available to the public, as they are in multiple Nordic countries, a policy choice that has contributed to far less tax evasion and inequality. So I'm going to start with you, Mr. Lord, because not only did you pitch me this piece that Kenny wrote, but I need to understand the importance of what Charles Littlejohn did, because I love ProPublica, okay? And what ProPublica has done in exposing the rot both at the Supreme Court level as well as what we're seeing now with these billionaires is so important, because in a democracy, knowledge is power. And therefore, if knowledge is power and you want to make sure that people don't have power, you keep them in the dark. You keep them without access to the kind of key information so that they will be able to evaluate not only the leadership coming out of governor's office and out of the White House, but they will also understand how the policies that have been passed by members of Congress either protects them or undermines them. And without knowing, for example, what the incredibly very wealthy are paying in this country and the kind of tax avoidance they've been able to buy through Congress, you will not understand why your democracy is at risk, because you don't have this information at your fingertips. So tell us a little bit about what Charles Littlejohn did and why it was so important, because in the revelations that we were able to obtain through ProPublica and New York Times, we learned a lot about how little they contribute as opposed to how much we do.
Thanks, Arnie. Well, that was a great lead-in, because you summed up very well how critical it is that we know what's going on with the wealthiest and most powerful people in terms of how the system is rigged, how they're paying less tax, a lower percentage rate of tax than the rest of us. And there are people, myself included, who have done just huge amounts of work. I've been doing this pretty much full time for the last couple of years, but there are people who have been doing it for decades. Economists like Gabe Zucman and Emmanuel Saez, a lot of tax professors. And we've been working to try to ferret through whatever information is out there to show the public how badly the system is rigged, how little these folks are at the very, very top who have amassed immense wealth, and through that immense wealth, immense power, how little they're paying in tax. And it's only been, you know, occasionally that we've gotten glimpses of specific individuals, what's going on with them. I was very lucky a couple of years ago. I was looking at Phil Knight of Nike's SEC filings, and through that, I managed to reverse engineer his estate and gift tax avoidance planning. I think he moved about $6 or $7 billion of wealth from himself to a trust for his descendants without paying any estate or gift tax. Zach Mitre at Bloomberg did the same thing a decade or so ago with Sheldon Adelson. But other than those couple little victories here and there, we haven't been able to expose what on an individual level what's going on. Gabe Zucman and Emmanuel Saez have shown as a group for the entire top 0.01% or the top 400 individuals what's going on tax wise. But you really need to see what the individuals are doing. And so what Charles Littlejohn did by providing these tax records to ProPublica has just opened up a world to us in terms of our ability to see what's going on. Things like one billionaire stashing $5 billion into a Roth IRA and paying zero income tax. He will never pay income tax on $5 billion of income. The massive use of trust to completely avoid estate and gift tax. I probably, if I had to guess, about 20 hours or so total giving technical help to the writers at ProPublica on the work that they did. And by the way, the work they did with this, with the information they were given was unbelievable. It was so critical to the public good, so in the public interest, that this information be released. And ironically, the judge who sentenced Mr. Littlejohn to the maximum focused on him releasing, I think it was Trump's tax information, and saying, and Kenny probably knows this better than I do, I'll let him speak to it, but saying that we wouldn't have people running for office if they were afraid that their public, that their personal information would be released. Well,
wait a minute.
Everyone else who runs for office releases it voluntarily.
No, you have to file a fiscal report. You have to show people your finances. I mean, I hate to break it to you, but that's part of the requirement. You don't run for any office without disclosing your finances. It may not be precise in the way of an income, but think about all the other presidents who've run for office. They all have exposed themselves and their financial records. It didn't stop them or chill them from running.
And not just president, by the way, Arnie. When I ran for Congress, I had to divulge my financial information and other things about my life were wide open for public review. Someone could go look
Right.
at my divorce file and see
Exactly.
that. But this one little item that's so important, their tax filings, that they're allowed to keep secret. It makes no sense.
Well, but on top of that, that the judge would suggest that people wouldn't run and that it would have a chilling effect on rich people running for office, which may not be such a bad idea, by the way. It would be kind of nice if like middle class people could run. I don't want it to be a place where it's only made up of the rich, the retired, and the remunerated. I mean, which is ultimately what happens here. But the fact of the matter is, it's not. It's not. You know, and you can see that across the board, whether it's at the governor's level, whether it's the congressional level, about all the disclosures that these people do, and they're still scrambling to run for office, you know, and everyone knows that they're rich because they're self-funding their campaigns. I can point to a number of governors in my state that everybody knew they came in with gobs of money because they had to disclose it, and then they used their gobs of money to buy the freaking seat. I mean, it's not like this is a shocker here, but what so surprises me is what you said the judge said, because how naive is the judge, because the judge is already disclosing his political agenda, not his judicial agenda. Because if he understood justice and he understood history, he would know that what he said was patently untrue. I mean, think about that. That's what he did. It was political, his position. It wasn't, in fact, judicial, that statement. I mean, I hate to break it to you, but that's how I feel. So you're telling me that what was so important of what ProPublica did and the New York Times did was to expose this. I guess I'm going to ask before I toss to you, Kenny, is that do we care enough about how they don't pay? Because frankly, what a lot of Americans believe in having run on tax policy, I'm a lunatic, okay? I ran on fair taxes. I ran on implementing an income tax in a state that doesn't have one. Here's what people said to me, listen to this. They said, right now, Arnie, for example, in New Hampshire, you have your hand deep in my property tax pocket. All right. And for a lot of people, believe it or not, if you're low income or middle income and you happen to own anything, you could be paying as much as 30 to 40% of your income in property taxes. Is that sick or that's sick? But that's because that's the only tax that we do really well. All right. And their fear was that if I introduced an income tax, that suddenly my hand would go into another pocket and that I could now take income as well as property, as if instead of being able to sort of create a little more fairness within the entire tax structure. And they basically said, if you're giving the rich a pass, maybe we'll have a shot at getting a pass too. So they don't necessarily are angry as much as we would like them to be about the fact that the rich don't pay. They want to be like them.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I think the message actually is getting through that the system is rigged by the people at the top. And that's what they're afraid of here. That's why what Mr. Littlejohn did was so important, because it helps break through the problem that you had when you ran for office and that I had when I ran for office.
So Kenny, you write this piece. It's not written by Bob, and Bob seeds the value of what Mr. Littlejohn did. And I do. That's what whistleblowers do. The problem is, this is a whistleblower that probably broke the law. Okay? And not all whistleblowers break the law. A lot of whistleblowers expose the rot, point out people that are breaking the law, but they themselves don't break the law in order to point out that someone breaks the law. That's not usually how it works. Here's the problem I think people don't understand. If you were rich enough to buy the loophole, to buy the public policy, to buy the tax cut, and then on top of that, you don't have the obligation to expose how much you have benefited. The only way we're going to find out what you bought and how much it benefited you is if we have someone like a Charles Littlejohn. Okay? I mean, it's like we need someone to do this. I guess I'm going to start this way. Why did Charles do it?
Well,
what was his rationale for doing it? I mean, I understand it, and maybe I would be willing to give up potentially 5 years of my life to do it as well. But I feel like, you know, you look at all these things and you look at the risk these people are taking, and why they're taking it is always curious to me, because it really is about serving the public good and public information. But because it's, quote, at least on paper, illegal, you end up, you know, wearing an orange jumpsuit.
Right. And, Charles did say that he broke the law, but I think he broke the law for a good reason and all those reasons that Bob explained. And quite frankly, as you alluded to, Arnie, he had no choice. This was the only way, really, to expose this type of tax injustice. And that's why I mentioned at the beginning, in some countries, this kind of risky political activity that Charles
It's
Littlejohn
legal.
engaged in, it wouldn't have been necessary actually, because this tax information is much more transparent. And that level of transparency makes it harder to evade taxes. And it actually makes it harder for super wealthy people to amass such a harmful concentration of wealth in the first place. But alas, in the United States, it was thanks to Littlejohn that we were able to see just the extent to which billionaires are skirting their taxes. And so that's, I think, and he did say that he wanted greater transparency. So I think he was certainly acting in the public interest. And, most whistleblowers, at least the whistleblowers that we all remember, they have broken some kind of law, but there used to be greater protections for whistleblowers. And in the last few decades, there's been this concerted effort to make whistleblowing more dangerous, to detract people from doing it. And if I could just go back to some of the things the judge said,
Please
Honor
do.
Reyes is her name. She's the federal district judge. And I was actually surprised. I kind of assumed, based on some of the things she was saying, that she was a Trump appointee. She's a Biden appointee. And the reason I thought, man, this might be a Trump judge is because she did say she kind of focused in on the fact that Charles exposed Trump's tax records, as if that was the only person that he had targeted. But that's not the case. That conveniently neglects the fact that he was exposing billionaire tax cheats as a class. But excuse me, Trump just happens to be one of them. But yeah, so she made
Good
it sound
point. Good
like
point.
an attack on the president. She said that it would be open season on elected officials. And I just have to say, I agree with you, Arnie. Like, if you're a super rich person who's nervous about what the public might think if your tax information were disclosed, it's probably better for all of us if you don't run for office. So,
But it's not going to stop them. Let me just say something. It's not going to stop them. I
true.
mean, in a lot of ways, look at Donald Trump. We now have turned Donald Trump into Jesus Christ. We laud his wealth. We laud his cheating. We laud the fact that he avoids things. I mean, you and I don't want to admit that, but there are millions of people that don't see that as a detriment. But there are people like me that want to know the facts, because there are that group in the middle that, if they could be persuaded, they would be persuaded by their financial obligation and the lack of financial obligation on the part of billionaires and incredibly wealthy corporations. If you're a small businessman and you're struggling with your taxes and you see, companies that are making billions and trillions in profits and not paying a dime, and in some cases, Kenny, they're actually getting a check back from the federal government.
Right.
I mean, talk about putting your fingers up in stereo. I mean, I would make those people into, like, posters all over the United States, but we don't do this. But that's why what the judge said was so horrifying. But you make an interesting suggestion, and you make a suggestion both on moral grounds as well as political grounds, that Joe Biden should, in fact, pardon him. So explain to us that pitch.
Definitely. I think the moral case has basically already been made by Bob because of the public interest that Charles served. And so just exposing the deprivation of billionaires in this country and in not contributing to the common good, I think that's the moral case. So, Charles should not languish in prison, and certainly not for the length of time that he's been sentenced to. That's what's really one of the things that's really outrageous about this is that Attorney General Merrick Garland's DOJ sought the maximum sentence of 5 years, and then the judge did give him the maximum sentence. So there's a moral case because he acted in the public interest. Also, that whole point about this information should be public, I think, is key here because he had no choice but to disclose this in a way that's currently illegal. So I think that those kind of tax secrecy laws are unjust. So there's those things on the moral side. Politically, I think that this would be a winning move because in the past few, actually just past couple months, there's been a ton of really great reporting and research that's been published about tax inequality because we've kind of come up on that. People now have the data where they can look back and say, here's what happened during the first 5 years of the Trump tax cuts. And so ITEP, the Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy, released a report showing just how little corporations have paid in the first 5 years of the Trump tax cuts. And then the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS, released another one saying that there's 35 corporations in this country that paid their executives more in the last 5 years than they paid in taxes. But so notwithstanding all that excellent, those excellent reports, I'm afraid that your average voter in this country might not be aware of that. And so, but the reason why Biden should act is because tax fairness and making sure that the wealthy pay their fair share is still one of the few issues in this country that has a lot of support across the political spectrum. People are really upset that billionaires pay less than teachers and nurses. But they just might, I just don't think everyone's quite aware of the fact that Trump made this problem much worse.
Yeah.
Biden has done some things to try to make it better. There's been some congressional obstruction in some cases, but basically you could make the election about tax fairness. You could say, my opponent, Trump, is a billionaire who cheats on his taxes. He wants to make it easier for rich people and corporations to cheat even more. And they're going to pay for those tax cuts by cutting your Medicare and your Social Security.
And Trump wants to make them permanent cheats.
Exactly.
Because these were temporary tax cuts. And what Trump will do is make them permanent tax cuts. And here's something that Bob, you and Kenny don't talk about. So when Trump cut corporate taxes by an amount the corporations didn't even imagine, I mean, they cut it to 21%. And everyone's like, whoa, corporations like were hoping like for 26. You know what I mean? It was like 21. Oh my God, this is like, you know, Christmas. And then he cut the money for the tax policy, tax responsibility for the wealthy. So here's what people don't understand is that what he did by cutting those taxes was he then gave them the additional cash so that they can buy your politics, so that they can buy your judges, so that they can buy your government. They don't even feel it because we gave them all this money back. And all of a sudden now they don't have to go into their pocket to invest in a campaign. They don't have to go into their pocket to invest in dark money. Where our tax dollars now being gifted back to them is paying for them to corrode the system even more, not only to drain Social Security and to drain Medicare, to not invest in our infrastructure, to not deal with the climate crisis, you know, not to repair a bridge that just fell in Baltimore. But on top of that, we're paying them so that they can ultimately buy and sell our politics. That's what that money is going for. It is not going for good things. It's going to dismantle democracy.
Exactly. That's so well put. And it's like it's a disastrous spiral because the more money that they are able to hoard, the more they're able to buy policies that benefit them. And that I think just kind of cements both the moral and political point that we're trying to make. Because one more thing that the judge said, she said that Charles's actions were an attack on constitutional democracy, which I just find unbelievable that she said that, because in my estimation, Charles is actually doing more than a lot of people to try to make the United States more democratic, because tax evasion or tax avoidance, as you just pointed out, is really, that's an assault on democracy. Also, Trump has promised to pardon January 6th insurrectionists. So I did make the mistake of venturing into the Slate comments and people were accusing me of
I went into them too.
my suggestion was kind of this unacceptably politicized suggestion. But it's like Trump has already pardoned people for purely political reasons. I'm not saying that Charles should be pardoned only for political reasons. I'm just saying he should be pardoned for moral reasons. And I think there would be a political upside for Biden to do.
Okay, so Bob, I got an idea. So I was a fellow at the Kennedy School for a while, and I got to sort of schmooze with them. And of course, now we know with RFK Jr. and you know, his VP pick, who's also very rich. I'm wondering what she's paying in taxes, but that's another story. I think we should get remember the Profiles in Courage Award that they give at the Kennedy Library? I'm going to make the recommendation that the Profiles in Courage Award should go to Charles Littlejohn. Okay? Because everything that you're talking about is about protecting democracy. It's about protecting disclosure. It's about the fact that we need access to this information. I mean, Bob, let's be honest. One of the reasons why we're so upset about what's happening with all the delays in all the trials is that we're going to go to an election not knowing whether we're electing a crook or not. All right? Because he's managed to sort of play the mañana card. Well, you know what? The mañana card means that we could have the most corrupt human being on the planet who should be in jail for 100 years, but we will never know because we will not have had that disclosure. We will not have had that trial. We will not have that exposure. And that's exactly what Charles Littlejohn did, is that he saw these things of all these billionaires, not just Trump, and said the American people need to know. You are burdened this way. They are not. Is this democracy? And frankly, it is not. So Bob Lord, thank you so much for doing this and for pitching me this story. It's a really important one. Bob Lord is a senior advisor of tax policy at Patriotic Millionaires. And Kenny Stancil is a senior researcher at the Revolving Door Project. For those of you that don't know what the Revolving Door Project is, it scrutinizes executive branch appointees to ensure they use their office to serve the broad public interest. I nominate Charles Littlejohn for a Profile in Courage Award, and I hope someone else does as well. Thank you, gentlemen, for doing this.
Thank you so
much. Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. You're welcome. All right, everyone. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Artie Arneson. And producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. It's going to get even more exciting when we come back.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. Headline in some media today is that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. told CNN that he thinks that Joe Biden is a bigger threat to democracy than Donald Trump. That's not a surprise. It's clear that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is in this race to help elect Donald Trump. But the specific reason he gave is important. In his mind, Joe Biden is a threat to democracy because Joe Biden kicked Robert F. Kennedy Jr. off of social media. By the way, that's not what happened. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was kicked off of some social media platforms because he was spreading dangerous lies because of his anti-vaccination views. But this speaks to Kennedy, who's not only supporting Trump, but shares Trump's deep sense of personal victimhood. It is notable that two of the candidates for president, born into enormous wealth and privilege, both see themselves as victims of some cosmic injustice. And in the case of Kennedy, increasingly put that at the center of his campaign. And for Trump, it's been at the center of his campaign and public persona now for close to a decade. The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
It's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history, when your parents lived through things that looked so much like this, all the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place, and you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance, when you know for many people this will be their last chance, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth, when you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before, when Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news, when the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, and producer Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. And of course, you know, she was recording it on Monday morning. I saw this article at the Washington Spectator, and I will be honest with you, I don't read the Spectator often enough. Now, after seeing what was written here, I need to make it a regular on my morning reading. The title of the piece is something that you've heard a lot about because we've been starting to really focus on something called Project 2025, a 900-page tome about how the conservative Republicans, the MAGA Republicans, the libertarian Republicans, the fascist Republicans are planning on basically taking over this country, dismantling every aspect of democracy that you could possibly imagine, and then creating this sort of climate nirvana, where the climate crisis doesn't exist, there's only oil, coal, and gas, and your public health is expendable. And the title of the article was Project 2025, the latest plot against America. After reading it, I was frightened before. I'm now more terrified than I could possibly imagine, which also speaks to the brilliant writing of the author of the piece, Ann Nelson. She is the author of Shadow Network, Money, Media, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right. She is the recipient of the Livingston Award for Journalism and the Guggenheim Fellowship for Historical Research. She is an author, and a lecturer in the fields of international affairs, media, human rights. As a journalist, she covered the conflicts in El Salvador and Guatemala. She won the Livingston Award for the Best International Reporting from the Philippines. She served as the director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. In 1995, she became the director of the international program at the Columbia School of Journalism, where she created the first curriculum in human rights reporting. Since 2003, she's been teaching at Columbia School of International and Public Affairs, where her classes and research explore how digital media can support the underserved populations of the world through public health, education, and culture. Well, now we know that the American population is also underserved. And they're underserved because they don't know the facts. And they're underserved because they don't understand what this document, Project 2025, is, what it means, and how it will be so, so, so destructive to whatever we imagine is America. So, Anne, I want to welcome you to the program. I'm going to ask you to come back many times. Your piece was powerful. But one of the things I did as I was reading it was the last couple of lines just blew up at me. And I decided that I would sort of take them and post them on my Facebook page. And here's what I wrote. If there's anything the past 8 years have taught us about Trump, it is that the unimaginable is all too often achievable. Oh my God, Anne, it's absolutely true. Look what happened after the insurrection. He was able to not get impeached. He was able not to be removed. He was able to convince the Republican Party that the election was a lie. He's been able to skirt every single legal challenge to him that would have of any kind of consequence, you know, for the indictments and the crook that he is. He's been able to delay. He's been able to deny. He's been able to just do everything. And we thought that there was a justice system, but the justice system feels like it's failing us. And that's before Project 2025. And we keep thinking, you know, that accountability and the electorate would be able to sort of come to our rescue. But too often than not, they feel like they failed us because they don't have information at their fingertips. And they've been told a lie a million times. So the lie has become the truth. And I'm so scared. And again, I want to read that last line that really is in your piece. If there's anything the past 8 years have taught us about Trump, it is that the unimaginable is all too often achievable. So let me welcome you to the program and thank you, Anne, so much for doing this. And given your focus on sort of the international stories that you've been covering, okay, and your sort of your stepping stone in the journalism field, why the pivot? Or was the pivot actually long before Project 2025 was, you know, publicly disclosed? Because you have written a book called Shadow Network, Money, Media, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right. When did you decide to make that sort of the focus of so much of your time and attention? And what was that sort of inspiration there? One, I'm very grateful. And two, that really was, I think, what led you to the knowing that we must understand in the next couple of months in incredible detail what's in this horrific document, Project 2025. So welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. There were two pivotal points. One was more than 20 years ago when I was visiting family in Oklahoma and turned on the car radio and heard fundamentalist preachers becoming very overtly political and using blatant falsehoods to tell voters not to vote for a Democrat. And I was shocked. And as you know, writers file things away in their head and kind of keep an eye on developments. But then the second pivot was November 2016, when the New York Times told me that there was less than 1% chance that Trump would be elected. And we know what happened then. And I went back and said to myself, how did all of the major media get this story so wrong? And I started going back to the fundamentalist radio stations, the right-wing talk stations, looking at the donors, looking at the strategists, and saying, oh my God, this thing has been going on for 40 years while I was looking at other countries. And it's been happening under our noses, pretty much undetected, in terms of these donors, these media systems, and these strategists exploiting the disconnects in our political system. And I'm talking about state houses, I'm talking about the electoral college, I'm talking about the Senate, and the way voting is actually set up in our country. And saying, unless we peel this back and understand how they operated, we're going to be living at their mercy.
It's interesting where you started, because I too have been following Christian radio. You talk about going home to Oklahoma. Well, I went to school in Minnesota and my kids went to school in Iowa. Okay. And I remember driving around in much of that Midwest. There wasn't a lot of radio, but there was a lot of Christian radio. I mean, you couldn't avoid it. You couldn't avoid it. NPR is applauded for, oh, aren't they wonderful? But they're only one station on the dial. Christian radio is like 50 stations on the dial. And you can't avoid it. And as you point out, these Christian radio stations aren't just speaking from the Bible, but now they're using the Bible as a political weapon. Okay. And now they're using the church service on Sunday morning as an opportunity not to talk about separation of church and state, not to talk about the fishes and the loaves, not to talk about Jesus Christ, but basically talking about the fact that you have a Christian obligation to vote for A and not to vote for B. And they've made it so that they have now so enmeshed their political agenda and their Christian religious agenda that it's hard to decipher and you wouldn't even know it. And what's so sad, Anne, is that we were like so upset about Rush Limbaugh and we were so upset about Fox News and we were so upset about Newsmax that we never listened to the rest of the radio dial. And if they listen to the rest of the radio dial, they're like, they're just part of the whole cake that they baked, you know, and there isn't any place that they can go except to have all these messages reinforced, whether it's Rush 3 hours a day from 12 to 3 or whether it's Father so-and-so that's on at 8 o'clock in the morning or 10 o'clock at night. And I think by ignoring that, and focusing so much of our energy on what's being written in the New York Times or what's being said on NPR or what's being said on PBS is if somehow that is getting to the masses, they've never met the masses and they've never talked to them.
Well, and beyond that, they haven't focused on the swing states.
Yes.
And you cannot understand American politics unless you grasp the fact that Biden won the Electoral College by about 40,000 votes in 3 states. So the other 47 states really weren't in play here. And when you look at the swing states, and I'll repeat it for the benefit of the audience, right? It's Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Arizona, Nevada. You can throw it, well, North Carolina used to be one, now not so much. But these states are in all probability going to determine the next election as they have the last two. And so those are not voting populations that are getting up in the morning and reading the New York Times. I'm sorry. But you know what? The New York Times isn't even directed at them. The New York Times doesn't know how to talk to them. But these radio stations do. And what's happened is a ramping up of the violent language on these radio stations, which I can sometimes monitor, where they're not just saying vote for Republicans. They're saying that Democrats, and they name them, Hillary Clinton, Beto, et cetera, are demons, demons.
Yeah.
So by demonizing literally the political opposition, they are raising the potential for political violence as well as terribly exploiting their listeners.
And remember that they have two hands, and in one hand they have the cross and the other hand they have a gun. And I want you to realize this because that's exactly what it is. You are doing this because they're demons, therefore your cross. Okay, you are doing this because they're not patriots, because Donald Trump is the best patriot. His election was stolen. So you have a gun or you have a weapon. Please understand that's what's in both of their hands. Don't think differently. And both of them drive people to do things that as you point out, what was unimaginable is now probable and possible. I mean, it's going to happen. It's going to happen because think about it. What else is left? if they are tapping into your sense of country and your sense of religion, there's nothing in between. You can be hungry, you could lose your job, but you need someone to hate and you need someone to blame. And what they've done with the religious piece is they've pointed at who to blame. And what they've done with the patriotic piece is they pointed to the kind of civil war that they're encouraging. And I think if we don't understand how the two work hand in glove, we are going to not only miss what is going to happen in this election, but as you point out, Project 2025 is very familiar with the messaging. And the reason they're familiar with the messaging, Anne, is because they haven't been doing a Project 2025 just now. They have been building systematically on getting to what ultimately is their goal. And as I said to you before we began the show, Project 2025 is the seal of the prophet. They have always been talking about dismantling making capitalism work only for them. They've been talking about dismantling democracy. They've been talking about dismantling the judicial system. They've been talking about dismantling the EPA, dismantling public education. They've always had that as an agenda, but they were sort of crawling in a methodical way to accomplish these things and have done it to some extent. But when you read this 900-page tome, you realize there's nothing left because they have now decided everything is on the table and nothing is not possible.
Well, yeah, it is kind of like a neo-feudalism where you have these massive lords and all of us can be serfs, and they define what kind of income we get, what kind of services, you know, what kind of crumbs are left from their table, right? Probably just enough to keep us productive in their terms. But it is a neo-feudal system that they're laying out here. And I also want to say that It's important not to equate the Christian nationalists with the militias, with the tax powers that want to pay no taxes and have no public services. They overlap, but they are not synonymous.
No.
So the whole point of my book, Shadow Network, is to reveal how the coordination functions. And it functions, it's been functioning for decades at a very high level. It's been secretive. If you want to look at the purely militia political violence side of it, there's a terrific new documentary out on Apple TV right now called Against All Enemies about the way veterans have been radicalized by these forces and the dangers that they present. So I think in order to engage people who are lured into this system, which we must in terms of national security, we need to really understand the dynamics of that movement and how they're being exploited.
Okay, so let me just say something. They are not the same, the Christian nationalists and some of the folks that you're seeing with the Koch network, who are probably not even religious in any way, shape, or form. But there is an overlap, as you point out. And the word you did not use is the most important word. And here's the word: it's synergistic.
Yep.
And that is that when you bring them together, the toxic cocktail that you have created, because remember, what goes into a cocktail isn't the same thing. There are different items in the cocktail, okay? But then you get the drink, all right? And what you're now getting with Project 2025 is the drink. And the drink is poisonous, and the drink will dismantle it. And you begin first by sort of describing, like, who are the players in this Project 2025? It comes out of the Heritage Foundation. And I've heard the name the Heritage Foundation forever. In fact, I actually would go down to Washington. I've told people this before. And this is when the Heritage was not as crazy as they are now, or not as MAGA. They would let me use their radio studios to do my liberal radio station, my show, because I was down in D.C. They would say, Arnie, we have a talk radio station. You can use us. You can do your show from our... Literally, they would do that. I mean, it's just unbelievable. I mean, that's probably not possible, and I would not want to go there today, but that was possible 25 years ago. I mean, you need to know that. That's how long I've been doing this since 1988, Anne. I'm an old lady. And I know these boys from the before Heritage and now the current Heritage. So let's describe a little bit about who are the players in Project 2025, because some of these players will be known to people, some will be not, but they need to understand the overlap and the amount of money and the amount of expertise they've brought to the table to write this. Because there is a level of expertise. It's maybe not the expertise we respect, but it definitely is. These are inside the belly of the beast, and they know exactly what they want to accomplish.
Absolutely. And it's important for people to know that Project 2025 was originally released a few months ago, and it had something like 40 supporting organizations. Now the number of supporting organizations is over 100. So it's a movement. It's not simply a static document. Now, the first thing to know about it is who's funding it. And in analyzing the some hundred groups, there are two things to know about that. One is that a very large percentage of them are run by members of the Council for National Policy, which is an umbrella group that coordinates these organizations among the donors, the strategists, the media people, and the canvassers. So that's the coordinating body. The two major donors who have funded approximately half of the groups who've signed on to this are the Koch Network. And as you say, the Kochs have no identifiable religion. I tend to say that they worship mammon because it's all about corporate greed. The other is Leonard Leo and his Marble Trust operations, which have massive funding, $1.6 billion from a Chicago businessman named Barry Side. And Leo is a radical Opus Dei Catholic. And so you've got this very bizarre marriage between the virtual atheists, the right-wing Catholics, the Southern Baptists, and the increasing strength of the Pentecostals all coming together. Now, these are groups that would have been at each other's throats a century ago with nothing to do with each other. They have joined forces because this is a political project. It's not a religious or doctrinal project. When you get the groups together, you have the operational people who write the chapters, who describe the policies, disproportionately representing people who were inside the federal administration of Donald Trump. Right. So for the first time, you have people who have hands-on experience of how to run bureaucracies, how to manipulate them, and ultimately, in this case, how to purge them of professional civil servants and replace them with ideologues.
You talk about Opus Dei and Leonard Leo, and you look at the guy who wrote, I guess, the opening salvo on the Project 2025, who's also a good Catholic from, I think, Wyoming. You've got the evangelical Christians, you've got the Opus Dei Catholics, you've got the libertarian rich, you got, you know, the whatever. This is they're coming together for this. But what I think is so interesting is that the Catholics and the evangelical Christians don't really like each other. They don't really trust each other. And in fact, I know a guy who was this conservative U.S. senator who thought he was going to run for president on this sort of conservative ticket. And he thought he was going to be their nominee because he had all the credentials that they would want for someone who was incredibly, his name was Bob Smith. And the reason why this group of conservatives, it was a third party operation, chose not to endorse Bob Smith as their candidate for president was because he was Catholic. And he checked every other box, every other libertarian, anti-government, undermined democracy box, but he was a Roman Catholic. And what I think is so interesting is that when you look at what is brought together in this glue of Project 2025, none of them really trust each other. But at the same time, they all know that getting to goal is more important than creating a sense of trust or understanding of each other. And that's what this document is so scary, because in a lot of ways you would think you could like divide and conquer. But well, for whatever reason, the document is so successful in showing that it has this incredible Velcro, because they all understand the agenda of hating public education, of not wanting to fight the climate crisis, of making sure that the rich get richer. And there's more in common with what they want to destroy than the fact that they ultimately really don't trust each other, which I just thought was absolutely shocking. But one of the things I think is really important is your opening really sentence in the 10 things you need to know about Project 2025, and you're coming back because we're going to go through all 10 and we're not going to get through the first two. All right. And the first one I think is really, really important. I don't focus on Donald Trump a lot on the show because I don't think he's really the issue. I think the policies are the issue. I think Project 2025 is the issue. I think what's happening in Texas is the issue. What's happening in Iowa is the issue. I don't think Trump is the issue. And you write this line. It's not just about Trump. Project 2025 specifically states that it does not depend on a Trump victory in November. It explicitly directed at the next conservative or the next GOP occupant at the White House. Now, why is their success with Trump not essential? Because I think that they have understood that success doesn't just happen at that one location inside the Beltway. They've looked at other places for success, and they have actually seen it.
I've been watching these people for now, you know, going on a decade, and they always have a plan B. So Trump is a problematic candidate. They've embraced him because he worked for them in the past. But they will be ready to pivot if something happens, such as going to jail or whatever, to remove him from the picture. And what people have to understand is that whatever Republican Party they're great uncle voted for in the past. This is not it. The Republican Party has been taken over lock, stock, and barrel by extremists. These are radicals. And the, what they share when you talk about being against public schools, the libertarians, the Kochs, et cetera, don't want to pay any taxes, and you can't run public schools without taxes. They make their unholy marriage with the Christian fundamentalists who don't want a secular society. They don't want different faiths or non-faiths coming together and learning a shared citizenship, which is what public schools are for, and which they're often, not always, but they're often successful at. They don't want that. They want society divided into sectarian groups in which the fundamentalist theology is imposed on everyone else. So that's how they share these values. And everything in Project 2025 is about dismantling the federal government and the secular state and the egalitarian state and allowing their forces to dominate.
And it's not just about the money. And it's not just about the secular nature of public education. It's also about race. It's also about resegregating America. It's also about pointing, that's what the whole thing is about, the border and the immigrants and what's happening with blacks and the, you know, what happened with the mayor of Baltimore after the bridge collapsed, and they were referring to him as a DEI mayor. I mean, understand that they don't necessarily have to, they don't have to play the race card, but it's always there. Because this is about the replacement. Remember, that's the other argument. Why don't we want to change our immigration policy? Because we don't want to be replaced. And replaced isn't replaced from a religious perspective. It's replaced from they're not white and we are. And I think that there is, they don't have to talk about it, but I also think that that's part of what is holding them together. Am I wrong here?
I would push back a little on that. Okay. I think they're about winning. And I think ultimately the old journalist rule of follow the money is what's going on. And in order to follow the money, you've got to win the right elections. And so my theory, which for which I have some evidence, is that they've tapped out their Southern Baptist voting bloc, which they've been working on for years. Every Southern Baptist that's going to vote for them is pretty much enlisted at this point. What remains, if you go to Ralph Reed's statements, if you go to their radio broadcasts and look at their rallies, they're heavily promoting African-American and Hispanic Pentecostal leaders and local get out the vote of color in their target districts because they need to win them. So there may be, and I agree with you, there's always an underlying subtext of race, but we have to understand that the way that the public thinking about race has shifted since, let's say, the New Deal and the Civil Rights Movement, where there's a voting bloc, especially of males of color, who are moving away from the Democratic message of, oh, let's support them, to saying, okay, I've got a job, I'm a winner, I don't want to hear the Democrats' message, I want to hear the strongman message, because that's what I want to identify with. I see that going on, so I have to report it.
And again, I want to remind everyone that they don't need to elect Trump. They don't need to elect Trump, which is why if you don't understand Project 2025, you will lose the most important lesson of this election and what is happening moving forward. And we actually have proof of your second sentence after that. And realize we've only gotten through one of the 10, so you're coming back for sure. And the second sentence is, its donors and partner organizations have achieved effective control of the Republican Party through purging moderates and promoting their supporters. It is unlikely that any Republican candidate can successfully run without their support. We saw that happen in Iowa, where Governor Reynolds purged her Republican Party in order to get the most extreme voucher program in the country. We just saw it in Texas, where Governor Abbott went after with his attorney general and purged the Republicans who didn't support the impeachment of the attorney general and don't support vouchers. You are seeing this, everyone. We even have proof of it just within the last couple of weeks of what Governor Abbott did in Texas, let alone all the other states. So understand that they've been methodical at building their case between that and gerrymandering. Think about it. Between the wealth, the purging, and the gerrymandering, I mean, we don't even get to a November election where we have no choice, because not only is the only choice in the Republican primary, but now look who has been purged from the Republican primary.
It goes way beyond that. So people who are interested in this should look up precinct strategies. And this is an organization that is nationwide. And what they do is go down to the precinct level chairman of the Republican Party, precinct level. And they have purged thousands across the country. And this movement has been endorsed by none other by Donald Trump because it serves his purposes.
And so And I need to let you go. I'm going to tell the Washington Spectator, you must read it. There's no paywall. There's no excuse. The title of the piece, Project 2025, the latest plot against America. We've been talking with Ann Nelson, the phenomenal writer of this piece, who has just written a book that sort of revs her up in anticipation of what was going to happen, entitled Shadow Network, Money, Media, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right. Ann, you're coming back. We only got through 1/16 of your article, and there is so much here that we all need to know and share. Thank you so much for doing this, Ms. Nelson. I really appreciate it. This, everyone, is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, our producer, Dave Scott, and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You better-